Hey, this is Dave Infante. Welcome to Fine Pairs Tap Lines, a weekly interview series with brewing icons, industry insiders, and outspoken experts about the United States' most beloved and best-selling beers. It's modern American history, one beer at a time. What's the best beer commercial of all time, Tap Lines listener? It's a tough question to answer. Beer, as the country's everyman drink of choice, has had a closer relationship with television than wine or spirits since, well, the beginning of television, basically. That's spawned a sprawling canon of zeitgeist-reflecting, lexicon-expanding ads over the decades, as macro brewers hustling undifferentiated, or at least under-differentiated products, to the American drinking public relied in large part on the strength of marketing to build brand loyalty. By the end of the 20th century, this crucible had turned beer ads at their best into big-budget, high-stakes works of functional, lowbrow art. Which brings us, more or less, to What's Up. In 1999, Vinnie Warren was working at Chicago ad firm DDB and on the hunt for a hit idea for a Super Bowl spot for his client, Budweiser. The King of Beers was still selling better than Bud Light at that point, but just barely. And August Bush IV had been handed the reins to rejuvenate the flagging flagship with a fresh new creative vision. As it turned out, Warren had just the thing. The short comedy sketch he stumbled across would eventually become the basis for What's Up, one of the most celebrated and successful beer ads of all time. It didn't stanch Bud's slide, because at that point nothing could, but the ad and its follow-ups entered the phrase firmly into the American cultural vocabulary, and as a result, it was elected to the advertising industry's Hall of Fame just a few short years later. It's Vinnie Warren, it's Budweiser, it's How What's Up Went Down, and it's all right here right now on Von Parrish Tap Lines. Vinnie Warren, welcome to the Tap Lines podcast, my man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Vinnie, where are you joining us from today?
I am joining you from Chicago. I live in Chicago.
Nice.
Originally from Ireland, but I live in Chicago.
I was going to say, listeners, you may detect just a bit of a brogue, Vinnie, of Irish origin, but he's joining us from the Windy City. Vinnie, you're here today to talk about one of the most, I would say, recognizable, canonical, pivotal pieces of beer advertising, or hell, of television advertising in general, that's ever hit the small screen here in these United States. I'm talking, of course, about the Budweiser What's Up commercial that that you had a direct hand in bringing off, in putting into motion and capturing and immortalizing. We're going to get into how that came to be, the reception of the ad. We're going to talk about all that good stuff. Tap Lines listeners know we go deep here on the show. But before we do, Vinnie, you've had a long career in advertising. You're still in the business.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I work at a place in Chicago called Realm Agency. I've been in advertising for 30 plus years now. I started out in New York in the early 90s, and then I went to Chicago to work on Bud Light. And had a little spell in Boston, and then went back to Chicago to work on Budweiser. So I worked on beer twice.
Mm, the ad man on the road. Give us the context, Vinnie, to your recollection. You know, we're going back, what, 23, 24 years, right around the turn of the 20th century. Bud Light, in present day, obviously has struggles that our listeners are well aware of.
Yeah.
But Bud Light in that period, in the late 90s, you know, right around Y2K, whatever, this was, in hindsight, kind of the heyday, right? Can you give us some context on sort of what the American beer landscape looked like at that moment?
Sure, yeah. I mean, basically, when I came to this country, I was shocked that there were so few beers. They're all the same, Coors, Miller, Budweiser, you know, really light lagers. And that was a result of a bunch of things, including prohibition. But the situation was that these beers kind of monopolized the market to a degree. Craft brew wasn't really a factor. Budweiser was on the decline, but Bud Light was shooting through the roof. Light beer in the 80s and 90s was going through the roof. Double-digit growth every year for, you know, decades plus from Bud Light. Meanwhile, Budweiser is kind, domestically was kind of falling because it simply wasn't as fashionable, as cool as Bud Light.
Sure. You know? And listener, if you haven't yet, go check out our episode with Maureen Ogle, the historian and the author of Ambitious Brew, about the light beer wars. The second episode about the light beer wars is about Bud Light's rise, introduced in 1982 as Budweiser Light. Then they dropped the Weiser off of the end and just started calling it Bud Light by 1984. And it really starts firing on all cylinders, you know, as Vinny is describing, just starts shooting through the roof. Vinny, you mentioned that there's no real craft brew in the mix, right? Like microbrews, as they were called at the time, weren't...
Yeah, microbrews.
We're barely a thing. You know, Boston Beer Company, you know, does get founded in 1984, but it's doing just a tiny, tiny, vanishingly small amount of volume compared to the bigs. Anchor, the same way out in California. All the nascent, you know, craft breweries that would go on to become household names in the American drinking public, so to speak, a decade later, are really just kind of getting their footing. Because of that, Vinny, the heyday was not only for Bud Light and to some extent its competitors as well. I have to imagine, and honestly, as a consumer, I'm looking back on this, I consider it this way. I'm curious to hear your take. It feels like it was kind of a heyday for beer advertising as well.
It was. Well, it coincided with the peak of TV as a dominant medium in the 90s, and TV was what drove it. I mean, the Anheuser-Busch sales representatives would bring in little small VHS recorders and show their accounts the advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
And the advertising drove it. You know, the advertising really did drive it, and it was a time when you could kind of reach the mass of America comparatively easily, and Budweiser and Bud Light had very big media budgets and very big production budgets to produce these commercials.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it was very much the heyday, and it really felt like a war, you know what I mean? Like Bud Light was at war with Miller Lite and Coors Light and winning. Sure. And that was the backdrop. It was a corporate war. Yeah.
That's another sort of famous quote, infamous quote, I suppose, depending on which side of the war that you were on. But listener, if you don't remember, and Vinny, thank you for indulging me. You've probably heard this story many times before. But listener, the quick and dirty is that when Miller started coming on strong with Miller Lite, the original light beer from Miller, as they called it, they were backed with buckets and buckets of Philip Morris money. And, you know, they got the jump on Anheuser-Busch, and eventually Anheuser-Busch decided to take note and respond in kind with Bud Light. And somewhere along the way, August Bush the third, Three Sticks, as he was known, the sort of visionary and iron-fisted scion of the Bush family that was running Anheuser-Busch at the time, he was asked by a reporter, I think it was from Bloomberg Businessweek or something, and said, "What are you going to do about Miller?" Something along those lines. And he says, "Well, tell Miller to come right along. We'll bring lots and lots of money." So that's when they started pouring money into this business. And to your point, Vinny, they started to win because Anheuser-Busch, for whatever its latter-day woes are under InBev, and, you know, and into the present day, at this time they were the dominant firm, and they started to dominate. That's I went on a little jag there, Vinny, but I can tell you want to.
You're right, and August Bush III was also the guy, the visionary guy who linked up TV sports with beer advertising. Mm. That was another thing he did.
Yeah,
and he was they experienced the power of TV, and they liked it, and it was good, and it made friends for the brand, and the brand is everywhere, you know.
Yep. All right, a Vinny Warren 25, 30 years ago enters this milieu. He's here in the United States. He from Ireland. Now he is working in the American ad business. How do you get put on beer for the first time, Vinny? What's your first exposure to the Bud Light and Budweiser brands?
Well, I'd grown up watching a lot of really good English beer advertising in the 80s, and it was pretty funny and really good. Carling Black Label, Holsten Pils, and all these. And they really affected the culture, too. And they were funny, and I just liked the idea of being in beer advertising. I'd also, in my youth, worked in a pub in Ireland in my hometown of Galway, and this pub was insanely busy. I mean, it was just Irish college students drinking against the clock every night, and it was like Mardi Gras every night. And so I'd experienced, you know, I'd seen brands come and go, you know, like be introduced and take off and not take off. And I had a kind of a sense for what it takes to get people drinking, basically. So I figured I would, that would help me, and I was interested in it. I mean, it's a very interesting category because, you know, it's pure creativity. You know, there's nothing to say.
Yeah.
You know, there was never anything to say in Budweiser, you know. Nothing ever, you know, it's not going to change. The label might change slightly, maybe, some point, but that's it, you know.
Right. You can only say Beechwood aged so many times.
Beechwood
man.
Aged. Yeah, right. You know what's funny about the Beechwood aging thing? Research, because you know, on the bottle it says, you know, this is the only beer that's, we know of no Beechwood aged Budweiser. It says it on the label.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they did research, people, Bud drinkers thought that that meant that the Budweiser was aged in huge wooden beechwood casks, you know.
Sure, sure.
When in fact it was in metal, you know, stainless steel, huge vats, you know. But that was the image people had in their heads and was like, okay, if you want to think that, that's fine. Yeah?
Right, right. It's a much more artisanal, pastoral vision.
Oh,
than, yeah, right.
It's like Romans with their wine, you know what I mean? It conjures up such a nice image.
Yeah, well, Anheuser-Busch certainly had an empire that maybe rivaled the Romans in some capacities. But the Beechwood aging, if I remember correctly, it was just like Beechwood staves that they would put into the vats.
Staves.
Yeah.
They would put it into a torpedo.
Yeah.
And the torpedo was screwed into the vat, and the bubbles would adhere to the beechwood staves, naturally carbonating the beer. That was the function of the beechwood aging.
Yeah, yeah. So to your point, I mean, you know, in commodity product, you know, once something becomes a commodity, which by this point in the market, you know, light adjunct lager, adjunct lager, I suppose, in Budweiser's case, certainly had in the American market, there's not a whole lot of differentiation. And this is a point that's belabored, you know, throughout beer media and I think popular media, right? The idea that sit people down, do blind taste tests, it's going to be hard to consistently pick out competitors from one another because the liquid is not heavily differentiated. That makes it easy to produce at scale, right? Like there's a benefit to that. They can capture enormous volume that way. But the downside is when they tap a Vinnie Warren to say, hey man, come up with some good ideas about why our beer is different. You got to really dig into the creative lobe of your brain because to your point, there is not a whole lot of factual substantial stuff to say there.
There's nothing to say, and it's all light lager, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I like lager.
Totally.
I grew up drinking lager in Ireland, but there's nothing to say for it. And so what you've got to do is you've got to figure out, you've got to be the one that is the most attractive to the young drinker. I mean, that's basically the job. And so that's the goal. The goal is to recruit young people who are like, hey, yeah, I'll try it. Sure, yeah, why not? You know?
Yeah. So speaking of goals, because listener, remember, we're here to talk about certainly about the advertising moment that the WhatsApp ad, you know, comes to be in, but also about the ad itself. Vinny, you were kind enough to send over a document. I believe it was a progress report from your time at the agency working at this. It's dated November of 1999. So we're less than 2 months away from Y2K. Remember, you're laboring under the threat of all the computers exploding and sending us back to the Jurassic era. But you still have time to dash off a progress report to the client over at Anheuser-Busch. There's a line in this progress report that stands out that I just think is phenomenal, and it speaks to what you're trying to accomplish. And the line is here, quote, "The goal is to have another huge hit for Budweiser, nothing less," close quote. You know, that's a call your shot moment there, Vinny. That's a big claim for a big client like Budweiser, a big account like Budweiser. They're expecting greatness from you. You're saying, you know, you and your team are saying, we've got greatness on our hands. Take us, you know, into, if you will, where you're at in November 99, where you're at as you sort of put the spot together.
Well, what happened was, I think it was September 99, a friend of mine, Carol King was her name, showed me a short film, and the short film was the basis of the commercial. And in the short film, which I saw on a VHS tape, a bunch of African-American guys were shouting what's up at each other, just like in the ad. And I saw it and I loved it. And I would show this tape around to friends and they would like it and laugh at it too and ask to see it again and again. And the next time we'd meet, they'd shout at me, what's up? And I'd go, what's up? And we'd laugh and all that. And that made me think that everybody in America might have this reaction to this film. And so that was the thing that attracted me to it, was the idea that everybody in America would say, what's up? I thought they would, because the thing was so likable, and the whole thing, I could just see it as a butt ad, because in the short film, they were watching sports on TV. They were watching a football game. You never saw it, but they were watching a football game. I'm like, well, that's where we advertise. And that's where our people are when they see this ad.
Yep.
So if we have got an ad where guys are drinking beer, watching the same game you're watching, it would be just be a nice, you know, very, very appropriate pairing. And so that was the thing that attracted me to it. And I showed it to my boss. I worked on Budweiser at the time. And I said, hey, look, this could be one of those, maybe. Remember, I Love You, Man, you know? And he was like, okay, yeah. And he showed it to the client, and they saw it too. They were like, yeah, it could be working. But you have to bear in mind, this was not the only idea they were buying. They were buying like 30 or 40 ideas for the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
the Super Bowl was coming up, and this was for the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And they liked it, and they went, yeah, okay, let's do it, you know, because we showed them the film. And then a couple of weeks passed, and the ideas that had been bought at this meeting where What's Up was bought were getting funded and in production, and What's Up wasn't. Mm. So I was getting paranoid. I was thinking, oh, great. It's because it's African-Americans. It's because it's this. It's because it's...
Too high concept. It's too weird, whatever. Yeah, gotcha.
I was worried about it. So that's why we did that progress report. There actually was no progress. That's why we did the report. Just to remind them how great this thing was, you know? And now was the time. And it was probably all in my head, because we got 3 weeks later, we were making this thing in New York when we were making the very first What's Up commercial. And that's how it happened. And it was relatively smooth. There was no, I remember at the time advertising people wanting it to be some battle or something that I had to, oh, you guys got to do this. And you're crazy if you don't move us up. Mm. They were like, okay, yeah, we'll try it. Yeah, go ahead, do it. And we went and did it. And they were like, yeah, that's great. Let's put it on the air. So we went and did it, and it was for the Super Bowl of 2000 and intended for that. And when they saw it, they went, oh, my God, this thing is great.
We
got to put this on the air right now. So they put it on the air the next day.
Whoa.
It was crazy. And within weeks, it went through the roof. Everybody was saying it. By the time the Super Bowl came around, it was irrelevant. I didn't care a shit about the Super Bowl.
That's very unusual in this day and age, Vinny, to preempt your own Super Bowl commercial. I mean, that's unheard of, right?
But that was those guys. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And they were like, there's no point in hanging on to this one. Let's put it out there. They'd reacted to it like consumers reacted to it.
Yeah.
They were like, it's just fun. Let's do it, you know?
Yeah. So they had a hot hand, and they were like, well, God, let's get it on the air,
let's
man.
Do it now, yeah. That was their attitude, which was great for me. I was delighted. I didn't care. I just knew that if we got this out there, it would get a reaction that wasn't the usual reaction to a beer commercial. You know?
Yeah.
The whole point was, I didn't want something that you would just laugh at and go, ha, 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 that's funny.
Yeah.
You know, because I've had that experience, and it wasn't as good as I Love You, Man, put it that way.
Right.
Yeah. I Love You, Man was the model for me, because it was a Bud Light commercial that I didn't do, but I was around when it happened, and it was a catchphrase hit as well.
Yep.
And I had plenty of time to contemplate why it was such a hit. And that was kind of an influence on me. I wanted that. I wanted that again, you know?
Unpack that a little bit for our listeners who may not be as savvy or exposed to sort of the inner workings of advertising. You say you had time to contemplate why it was a hit. Why do you think something like I Love You, Man made it into the lexicon, made it, you know, grabbed the American audience as much as it did?
Well, there's always, whenever these things, catchphrases, what I've studied it a bit, you know, since then, whenever a catchphrase hit, it hits, it usually serves a function. And some function is social, usually. And in the case of I Love You, Man, I noticed that one of the reasons it was such a hit was because our young, largely heterosexual male audience, gave them permission to tell their friends that they loved them, when they were drunk. And that was a big thing. And that was a social function. It was fun when you said it, your friends would laugh, and I love you, man, too, you know. And it served a function. And it was kind of cathartic to say it. You know, it's kind of cathartic to say, I love you, man, right?
Yeah.
I love you. The way you say it, I love you, man. You know, it's like Borat is nice. There's a little bit of nervous energy leaves your body when you say it,
right?
Because you have to kind of lean into it a bit, and it's fun to say. So that was sort of that was what I noticed about I Love You, Man, and you know, obviously it was just a lesson I learned. So, but when I saw there was something, my thought was, by God, we could have I Love You, Man all over again here, and that's what I wanted. I wanted it to be I wanted a catchphrase hit. That's what I thought it would be. In addition to being funny, I thought it would be a catchphrase hit.
The I Love You Man, and then certainly What's Up, the Budweiser Frogs, some of these, yeah, the, Frogs, yeah. The ads. Well, listeners, we have an episode on the Frogs. Go check it out. Highly recommend it. But these ads, to me, represent a bit of a shift from the earlier body of work from the major American brewers, the Anheuser-Busch's, the Millers, the Coors, to some extent, of the world, where they're advertising the beer, you know, pitching the beer as Beechwood aged or brewed with Rocky Mountain water in Coors' case, or whatever. Right. And the commercials that would come on towards the end of the 20th century, like What's Up and some of the others, were not advertising the beer as directly anymore. They were advertising a culture, you know, in sort of a camaraderie or a community that forms in what the industry now calls occasions, when you might be drinking beer. Talk a little bit about that shift, if you will. I mean, you were working on not just pitching, you know, the glamour shot of the Budweiser being poured into the glass. That would have come across as tacky or corny to the viewer that you were trying to reach. Talk a little bit about that mind, that like shift in perspective or paradigm with the advertising that you were working on.
Well, I think what happened was they'd, you know, as the 80s turned into the 90s, the culture seemed to be very sort of self-aware and ironic, you know, and things like, you know, work reward strategies from the 80s of, you know, people, you know, having a Miller Lite after a hard day at the steel mill.
Right.
There was a lot of things that were considered old fashioned, including beer pours and all that stuff, which I, by the way, I knew at the time I loved beer pours. So I did a spot that was just about a beer pour because I loved it. Because nobody was doing beer pours.
You're pushing the boulder up the hill. Vinny.
It was funny because it was such an out of touch instinct that it actually worked.
Right. It came back around.
People hadn't seen a good beer pour in a while. It was funny as well. But things had changed, and branding and marketing had shifted, and it was all about trying to get into the culture, at least for us. And the Budweiser Frogs was the one that kicked it off for that brand, because that was a huge hit. And that campaign was lingering right up to the end when What's Up came out. In fact, What's Up was what killed that campaign of the lizards, the frogs. Animals. And, you know, animals talking, which I didn't like because animals don't drink beer, you know. And fundamental flaw.
Who gave that right frog there. A beer?
Yeah, you know, it seemed a little bit childish to me. You know what I mean? If you're 18 years old, you know, talking animals, really? And so I wasn't a fan of that approach for that reason, because, you know, if we're trying to be like the defense, it was very popular. I mean, I remember somebody telling me that, you know, it's the most popular beer advertising in America. And I was like, yeah, but if you're 18 years old, this is not cool, you know? And I wanted to do something for that audience, because that's the audience. The audience is, you know, our audience was the audience that grew up loving, you know, Tupac and Eminem and Biggie and all that. So an African-American cast all of a sudden I knew would resonate at least with the younger audience.
Mm-hmm. So you present the spot to Budweiser. Who did you pitch it to? Did you pitch it
August
to the 4th?
The 4th.
Yeah,
August
so the 4th himself.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, for listeners who maybe aren't apprised, some of them are, because, you know, Tapline's a beer history podcast, and obviously the Bush family looms large in American beer history. August Bush the 4th had a lot of woes over the course of his career, but there was a moment, and I think this more or less fits into that moment, where he was the shining heir apparent, right? Like, what was he? Do you remember what his role was when you were pitching him?
Yeah, he was, it was his dad, August the 3rd.
Sure.
There was a guy in the middle called Bob Lackey, who was between the two. And then there was, at least in my estimation, and then August Bush the 4th came along, and he was put in charge of Budweiser. So this was his big moment, you know? And he was, you know, a bit of a playboy, a bit of a, you know.
Notoriously, yeah, sure.
And to give the credit where credit's due, the Bush family really understood their business, and they really understood the category, and they took chances. And that's kind of how What's Up happened. Was it came from their attitude of like, just try it, and if it's a hit, great, and if it isn't, we probably get a hit from somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
That was their attitude towards the advertising.
Yeah,
they wanted. What we delivered, you know what I mean? It wasn't like this came out of nowhere. They'd had a history going, you know, with Bud and Bud Light going back at least 10 years of having spots and commercials that resonated in the culture, you know?
This was also an era, I think it was Rhetoric. Shame on me. I should know this. Well, no, I guess a few years later, but the fourth would go on to probably not indirectly related to the success of What's Up, because it was tremendously successful in its own right, by the way. Listener, if you're not aware, the spot would go on to win the Grand Prix at Cannes and the Grand Clio Award, and I believe it's in the Clio Hall of Fame. Is that right, Vinny?
It is,
that
yep. sound
right
yep.
Yeah. I mean, so we're just talking about a tremendously, canonically successful ad. But what I was going to mention is that just a few years later, in 2007, Budweiser would go on to launch, Anheuser-Busch would go on to launch Bud TV. Yes. Remember that, Vinny?
I do. I was there for that.
Now, Bud TV was a failed project, and I think the thesis was wrong for a bunch of reasons, and hindsight is 20/20, sure.
Yeah.
But the idea that Anheuser-Busch is creating culture and is creating, you know, characters and plot lines and stories that people want and care about, that part of it, I think, was right on. I think that idea was good, you know?
I think it was. I mean, you know, but obviously, hindsight is 20/20, but that was just another of their explorations into how they can get Budweiser into the culture and how they can be in tune with the times and be in tune with their consumers. And that's ultimately what they were about. You know what I mean? They weren't doing this for fun. They weren't doing this to be cool. They were doing it because it worked. And they understood their target market very well. And that's it. So the whole thing was basically that. You know, they were about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Let's talk. I jumped ahead momentarily to Bud TV and to the decade that follows, but let's talk about the contemporary reaction to What's Up. I mean, internally, huge buy-in. You mentioned that it hits the air and, you know, it's already sort of in the lexicon or in the ether by the time the Super Bowl, you know, arrives just a few months later. And you know, I mentioned the awards that it would go on to win. What was the rank and file experience like going to a bar or hanging out with a group of target demographic drinkers? Like, you were there for it. You're seeing this spot sort of catch on. When do you know this thing is not just an internal hit, not just a hit that's going to move, you know, more cases, but is actually entering the culture and is going to stick for a long time, Vinny?
Well, I remember when it first aired, I had a thing where I used to go to sports bars and see my commercials there for the first time and get the reaction of the
fun,
you know, the people in the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And normally it would just be, ha, 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 you know, they laugh and that's it. You know? And in the case of What's Up, I went to a sports bar. There was an NFL game on, I think it was, or NBA or something. I don't know. NFL. And I went and I sat in the bar and What's Up comes on, you know, first time ever on American TV. And 60 seconds of silence, nothing. The audience was looking at it, like staring at it, like, what the hell is this? And I was like, oh no.
You worried it's going to bomb.
Oh yeah. So, and then it came on again and a couple of people laughed. And I was like, oh, that's better. And then it came on a third time and everybody laughed. And they were laughing really hard and poking each other and going, isn't that funny and all that. And I was like, okay, that's good. That's a good reaction to have there, you know.
I'm not fired.
And then about a week later, there was a little article in Newsweek about it. And it said, you know, What's Up? In a little cartoon of the What's Up guys. And I was like, well, that's interesting. You know what I mean? But when I really knew it was going to be huge was I went back to Ireland, you know, a month or two later. And I was in Ireland, and I was just hanging out, and it was about 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night, and the pubs were emptying. And What's Up was happening in America, and I was like, oh, it was well on its way. It was, you know, people were loving it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was standing outside this bar, and all of a sudden I hear these young Irish guys shouting What's Up at each other. And I'm like, how do they know about this?
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, yeah, the internet. Yeah, that's the problem here. And and that was like, oh my God. That's when I knew. I was like, oh, we got everybody here, you know? And then a week or two later, we were shooting in New York shooting sequels because it was already a huge hit and they wanted more. And so we were in New York shooting sequels. And it was Saturday night, we're in a hotel and all our phones go off, our big old 90s phones go off. And it's our friends and family telling us that SNL has opened its new season with a sketch that parodies What's Up. And I was like, oh my God, that's pretty interesting, you know? And I went from there. It was one of those things where it worked like we hoped it worked, like truly viral. Like you were exposed to this and you couldn't not say What's Up. That was the way it worked, you know? And that's the way it worked. So you had to try real hard not to like it. And so that was the thing that we'd hoped would happen and it ultimately did happen. And then it went, but it went into like mania territory. Like it went beyond. Like my reference point was "I Love You, Man," where everybody was shouting "I Love You, Man."
Yeah, yeah.
And it went way beyond that. You know?
Wow, wow. Yeah, the SNL moment has got to be huge. I mean, as an ad man, that's yeah,
and that was, but that was just the start. The funny thing was that would have been great had it been the only thing.
Right, if that was the pinnacle. Yeah,
that was only the start. That was just the start. It went up, 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 up from there, you know?
Well, Letterman did a...
Letterman, everybody did it. It was crazy. Movies did it. When we were shooting the second round, we got a call from the Wayans brothers asking for a tape of the original. I didn't know, but they were doing a shot-for-shot remake in Scary Movie, you know?
Yeah,
that,
right.
That came out a year later, only right. A year later. Like, there was something about it, too, that people just couldn't resist parodying it for some reason. You know, they wanted to do their own version of it. And everybody, it was so easy to shoot because it was just cut from guy here, guy here, guy here, guy here. It was very easy. It was shot very simply, so it was very easy to parody.
Yeah. You mentioned just a moment ago, and this is something that I think is worth sort of pressing on a little bit because it's a question that I had that I wanted to sort of put to you as well. You know, a lot of its success, I mean, the internet, of course, was around, but this is pre-YouTube. This is pre-social media. I mean, people are sending chain emails and sharing, you know, videos that are coming in little Winamp players or whatever the case may be.
That was how it went around the world.
Yeah. Of course. So this is something that existed prior to sort of the vectors or the pipes by which, you know, content now ricochets around the planet in, you know, mere seconds.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you, having lived through that era, and then, you know, this is 1999, early 2000s, and then now, you know, 24 years later, we have TikTok, we have Instagram, we have Snapchat, whatever the case, you know, name your platform. Mm-hmm. Was there something about that moment, that era for where consumer technology was, where, you know, sort of platform networking was on the internet that allowed WhatsApp to like grow organically? Like, in other words, was it a product, do you believe, of its time in that regard? You know, something like this maybe doesn't last as long in our current moment, right? Like this hits and is gone in a minute.
Well, the thing that separated WhatsApp from other things, whenever the time, was that it was just, there was a little bit of what I call executional magic about it. And that magic works today. It works. It just works whenever. You know what I mean? And there's no rational. It just happened. It was great. It was perfect in its way. But I think why it scored so big at the time was everybody was online, so they could send it around. They could all watch it on their computers at work, which is what they did. And
where were people watching videos on their computers in 1999? I'm trying to like eBombs.
I can only assume.
No, I know, but like, what were the sites?
Oh yeah, aggregator sites. There was lots of aggregator sites like eBombs World.
eBombs World is what I was thinking of. Yep.
And all those aggregator sites, that was the real thing. All those aggregator sites needed content.
Yeah.
And what's up, it turned out, was perfect for watching on a shitty little screen on your computer. It was.
Because it's mostly the hook. It's mostly the
guy, and then a guy, and then a guy, and a guy. There's no, it's not very intense.
Right. It's not a Michael Bay fight scene.
No.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that made it perfect. And you add in the catchphrase part of it, and it just, it kind of compounded on itself. But the timing was perfect. Yeah. We were right there with the right thing when people wanted it because they were all connected online.
Yeah. We came at this from one direction when you were talking about I Love You, Man. This idea that there's sort of permission for the viewer to, you know, be goofy, be vulnerable, be, in the case of I Love You, Man, maybe a little homoerotic and you know, like express real, you know, friendship that he is uncomfortable expressing if he's not drinking a Bud Light, whatever. That strikes me as like, I mean, that's a powerful insight, right? And you're not the only ad person that tries to capture that, you know, unlock that emotion, right? Because if you can, you've touched something real.
Yeah.
Why what's up? Why do you think this is what did it?
I think it was a lot of things, but I think it was silly. Mm. At the end of the day, it was just silly. And that helped. Like there was no, one of the things about what's up was that there was no laugh point in it. There was no joke. There was nothing funny in it.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Nothing funny happened in it. It was just a bunch of actual friends, which I think helped a lot. You could sense the chemistry between these guys.
Yep.
You couldn't fake it. Like, we couldn't have done a version of What's Up with different guys.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't have worked. And there was that chemistry that you just feel. There was the catchphrase. There was the it also did, because it didn't ask you to laugh, it kind of overwhelmed you.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what's up? It was just this crescendo, an editorial crescendo of what's up?
Yeah.
By the end of it, if you weren't laughing, something was wrong with you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it had that to it, too. It worked in a different way comedically than most beer gags. Most beer gags are jokes, you know what I mean? They're a joke, and then you laugh, and then you look, and then you laugh. This thing was just went all the way through. And it also, I think, because it was an African-American and Puerto Rican cast, it popped, and it was relevant to the time in a way that it wouldn't have been 10 years earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
That's actually another thing that I wanted to ask you. Were you working to get buy-in on that? You mentioned this briefly earlier in our conversation. You're like, gosh, maybe that's working against us. Maybe, you know, Anheuser-Busch didn't want to commission this. Was that a bold choice at that time? I mean, this isn't that long ago, 1999. Do you see that as, you know, sort of a groundbreaking choice for flagship advertising for Budweiser
It kind of was at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
When I came to this country, I was looking at it like as a second culture, almost as a second language. And I noticed that, you know, when you never saw African Americans in that commercials, unless it was quote unquote urban advertising.
Right, right.
And you know, or a sneaker commercial. And so I noticed that. But I also noticed the disproportionately large effect on the world and American culture of African-American culture.
Sure, sure.
I was very conscious of that, too. But I also, I knew that it was a thing. You know what I mean? It was, you know, Budweiser is a very white bread, middle American brand. You know, it was
very
heartland,
very, rolling fields of wheat. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And so the casting would have been unusual, but not an issue for the brewery because they wanted a hit.
Yeah.
And I wanted a hit. So they were like, yeah, who cares? And it was interesting because after the commercials aired, I remember there was a moment when one of the guys at the agency brought me into the office and he showed me two piles of printouts. One was racists complaining about the advertising.
Oh, boy. Yeah, yeah.
And the other one was African-American leaders complaining about the advertising because they thought it represented... They accused us of minstrelsy. And they didn't know the backstory, But that was I thought that was interesting. And then the interesting reaction to the brewery was, well, neither of these groups drink that much beer, so who cares?
Sometimes it's good to have a cynical corporate.
Well, they were right.
CC, yeah, well, they're right. I'm sure they were right. I'm sure they had the numbers to prove it.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, oh no, we lost the Southern Baptist demographic.
Who cares?
Well,
not
it doesn't
drinking.
Matter.
They're not drinking anyway.
They
you know?
Don't drink Budweiser or anything else. So.
Yeah.
That's funny, man. Vinny, tell us a little bit. I mean, you know, we've gone the distance here, and I know we've sort of unpacked a lot of how What's Up came to be and how it was received. I want to shift gears and talk with me, if you will, you know, a little bit about what the culture-making power of What's Up and the other ads that you worked on and other ads that your peers or your colleagues in the space worked on. You know, entering something into the American and the international English-speaking lexicon, which What's Up did, that's something that, I mean, pure out-and-out entertainment strives to do and doesn't always manage to do. For an ad to do it strikes me as particularly remarkable, and certainly beer ads are not the only advertisements that stick with people and that create and produce and reproduce culture. But beer ads do seem to be fairly, maybe disproportionately effective at doing that. This is more of a thought experiment than a direct question, but does that resonate to you? And if so, like, why do you think that is?
Well, I think where it comes from is that beer ads, you know, is about recruitment, number one.
Mm.
So that means it's got to be cooler to a younger generation, right? So automatically you're playing in more rich territory creatively. You're being more adventurous.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And the second thing is that beer advertising strives to be your friend, you know?
Mm.
And so when you're trying to be your friend, the best way to be your friend is to be humorous and make you laugh first, right? And make you like you second, right? So the first part is easy. Getting the laugh is easy. Getting that friendliness that you just makes you overrides your critical faculties and makes you drink the beer is another thing.
Yep.
You know? And so, for example, a good example of that would be the most interesting man in the world.
Sure.
Right? Makes no sense. Doesn't reference Mexico, Dos Equis. Doesn't give a shit. It's just trying to be your friend. And it works for that reason, because it's trying to overwhelm you. And in the process of trying to overwhelm you, it creates something a bit special, you know? So I think it's a bit of your, you have to have that as your goal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't want to just do something that was funny. No, that was, we'd already done that.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to do something that was beyond that. And that means you create something that's, that people just want to lose themselves in, and they just want to identify with, like the most interesting man in the world, you know? And that's it. It comes from wanting to do it. You know, I don't think it happens accidentally. You know, I don't think people have to go, okay, this is Budweiser. This is big. We got to kill this one.
Yeah.
You know, because one of the reasons was because we had so much creative freedom. These guys were very loose in terms of their, hey, go do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so when you're in that situation of creative freedom, as we had, the pressure's on you because you're the weakest link now. You know,
this
was the best idea you could do, you know? Apparently, you know, so there is that, that helps too, you know?
Yeah, that can free you up to create something fantastic, but it can also be a crash and burn situation, right? Where you get too much rope and you hang yourself type of thing.
Exactly. And they also had 5 minutes in the Super Bowl every year to fill. So
right.
That was another thing every year we had to fill that thing, and we had to win it as well. We had to have the number one most favorite spot of the game.
What was the most important metric at that time? Was it the ad meter? Like, what was everyone watching back then? Yeah, yeah.
It was, you know, the client wanted to have the most. They put 5 minutes. They had 10 spots, you know, in every game.
Yeah.
So they wanted to win it. They wanted to have the most favored by the USA Today ad meter poll. And they got it. I think it was 13 years in a row.
Yep, yep.
And so, you know, so that was demeanor was to be, we were more in the entertainment side of advertising than the advertising side of advertising.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
By virtue of the fact that it was Budweiser, everybody knows it. It's on TV all the time. It was something that had to be fed, you know?
Right. And if, you know, if they need to do a brand building spot rather than an entertainment spot, they wheel out the Clydesdales. They know how to do that with Budweiser.
Yeah, they had Clydesdales. And they would do things about, you know, the wheat and the barley and the hops and all that
stuff. Sure, sure.
You know, they would have, they didn't have, they had, but Anheuser-Busch had many constituencies.
Sure.
And they would serve them all, and they would serve the right thing to the very right, you know, they did it all, you know?
Anheuser-Busch was just, unbeknownst to you at the time, was just 8 years away from a hostile takeover from InBev that would turn it into Anheuser-Busch InBev. At that moment, and you know, from there on, a lot of industry observers and reporters, me included, you know, detect a shift in the business. I mean, to some extent, like Maureen Ogle, who I mentioned earlier in the conversation, the historian who wrote Ambitious Brew, you know, constantly has said to me over the years, like, it's just in name only, right? These are not the same companies. The ethos changes, the Bush family changes, or, you know, is no longer directly involved. And the beer market changes. I'm curious, like, you know, we talked a little bit about how this was an advertising heyday, a beer advertising heyday. Are there clients like Anheuser-Busch in 1999 anymore out there, Vinny? Like, does that exist anymore?
Well, I don't think in beer advertising.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the things that made Anheuser-Busch was the Bush family and their control over it and August Bush III. Like, for example, the decision to put it was up on the air, I think, was prompted by August Bush III or the 4th going to a restaurant in St. Louis with a VHS tape of the commercials and asking the bartender to put it in. And he did. And the whole bar went crazy. And he went, okay, now we're doing it.
Wow. Right?
Now, if that had that been a regular old American corporation that was, everybody was afraid and there was no real leadership, they would have went, oh, I don't know about this one. They had the power to do that.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And that's what made it different. It wasn't committee, and it was a vision, and there was a brand, and there was very strong opinions on what this brand stood for.
Yeah.
And you had to adhere to those things. And that's what made it good. And they were, they knew their business. I mean, look, the downfall of other brewers, I always thought, Miller Lite, I would look at their, this is before LinkedIn, but I would find out who they were and who worked there, you know? And the guys who worked at Miller and Coors, they'd be like, oh, I used to work on Pepsi, and then I worked on Toyota.
Sure,
and
sure.
Now I'm working on... Anheuser-Busch guys were Anheuser-Busch throughout.
Yeah, yeah.
They were beer, 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 beer.
I worked at Michelob. I worked at Budweiser. I worked at Bud Light.
and they were lifers, and it was a very strong culture.
Yeah.
And they treated their people well, and they were good. I mean, they were a great client. They're also a very tough client, and they, you know, if you did something wrong, it was trouble, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say that culture has largely disappeared. You know, you still find great clients in advertising, but rarely do you find one with that media budget, that place in the culture, and that sort of, you know, presence. You know, they're like Guinness. They're like Guinness in Ireland. I mean, Guinness in Ireland is the same thing. They're everywhere. They sponsor everything.
Yep.
You've grown up with them. And the challenge is to how to keep it fresh.
Yeah, but to your point, Guinness is a Diageo product these days.
That's
and
right.
And there was
and it's not as good.
Well, it's harder, I'm sure. It's harder, I'm sure, to get sign off on advertising than it was to, you know, pitch something to the third or the fourth and say, hey, they love it, we're going with it, right? There's more layers.
Yeah. Well, I also think that, you know, like, it has to be your goal. Like, it was these guys' goal. Because it was smart, because What's Up was essentially a global advertising campaign for Budweiser that aired for free on people's computers. I mean, I remember there was a site in France that collected all the What's Up's commercials. Beautiful site. And they had housed them all in a nice little site. And I realized...
In France, of all places.
In France. Yeah. And in France, they don't allow you to do cool beer ads. It's against the law.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that... And it was... And I remember it was huge in Japan, and it was... It went everywhere, but it was free.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, that, like, we didn't have to actually run the Budweiser What's Up commercials that much, because everybody was doing it for us, and they were, you know, they were literally, our jobs being done for it. And that's the beauty of something like What's Up, is the... It's free. It's the spillover is immense, and it lasts forever. And it's just you capture a generation in amber with your advertising,
yep,
by virtue of this. And so that takes vision.
It, yep,
just takes vision. And they had vision.
I mean, to your point, catching, you know, in amber, you know, the Anheuser-Busch culture that you described, the corporate culture that you described, may have gone by the wayside, you know, after InBev took over. We are now, 2020 would mark 21 years from when What's Up originally aired in December of 1999, in the lead up to that Super Bowl, you know, a month later. But just in 2020, I believe there was a redux of the What's Up, you know, commercial, yeah, that was, I forget what it was for. I think it was like a public service.
It was InBev. Or no, it was, what do you call it? COVID thing.
Yes.
It?
That's
it was,
what
it was, connected during COVID.
It was like, you got to check in on your friends, like, say,
yeah,
what's up. But, and you know, whatever, like, whether that spot was successful or not is less important than the point I was going to make, which is like, man, that is 21 years removed from, like, the original spot.
Yeah.
And it's still calling back with the confidence that a viewership is going to know what they're talking about. I mean, that's staying power, man.
Yeah, that was insane. One thing I noticed about it, because I'd been through I Love You Man, I thought it would be like I Love You Man, you know, where I Love You Man came and it went. It lasted a while, but
sure,
it went.
Sure, sure.
And I think that part of the interactive part of shouting was up and all that stuff, I think it hit the culture so hard at the time. Like, I couldn't believe the degree to which people wanted to say this. Like, I wanted them to say it, but I was surprised by the degree to,
right,
which they wanted,
right,
to say it.
Well, you mentioned Borat, and it is kind of like the My Wife thing, where it's like, okay, cool, we get it. You saw the movie, and like then people like won't shut up about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what makes it hate, is your personal association with it and the degree to which you like it. And so I remember when there was the UK Office came out a couple of years after the What's Up campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very first episode of the UK Office, David Brent, Ricky Gervais, to prove what an idiot and out of touch oaf the character is, he comes in, walks up to Gareth and the other guy, and he goes, "What's up?" And they go, "What's up?" And he goes, "Yeah, I love those commercials." Yeah, and what the point they were trying to make was he was an idiot.
Sure,
you know what I mean, they,
sure,
were trying to. He's the guy saying "What's up" when it's over, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember thinking that's kind of was funny. I was glad to be in the office, but I remember thinking, "Wow, that's interesting." That a couple of years later, this really cool comedy show is still referencing it and still using it. And it never stopped. I mean, it's, you know, like there's countless movies. I mean, every couple of months it felt like somebody would email me, "Oh, this saw this movie and this reference What's Up in it." And what's the guy, Andy Samberg seems to have an obsession with this movie. I don't know why, but he loves it. And it's one of those things where it's just like, it's in people, and when, and other people feel the need to recreate it.
Yeah.
For some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, go figure. All right, Vinnie Warren, we've gone to the distance here. Thank you so much for joining Taplines to talk, talk through what's up, talk through that moment in American beer advertising. You know, never before, maybe never again, but we're happy that that window opened up for creative forces like yourself and like your team that came up with the What's Up commercial to go out and produce a little bit of cultural magic. Vinny, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, man. Cheers.
Take care. Taplines is recorded in Richmond, Virginia, and produced by yours truly and Darby Seaside, who, along with the talented Shane Farrick, composed our delightful soundtrack. Just listen to it. I also want to give a quick shout out to the entire VinePair team, and especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, managing editor Tim McCurdy, and art director Danielle Grinberg, who designed our lovely Taplines logo. And of course, a big thank you to you, yes you, listener, for spending time with us week in and week out. We literally couldn't do this without you. I'm Dave Infante, and I'll catch you next time.